Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Opportunities with Clinical Lab 2.0, Adding Value and Creating Clinical and Operational Intelligence to Improve Healthcare Delivery. The presenter is James Crawford, MD, PhD, Professor and Chair Emeritus, Northwell Health, Greenvale, New York.
So thank you all for coming. I actually really appreciate your being here. I was looking at Tim Stenzel across the way in LDTs and thinking that's probably an SRO, but I really appreciate your coming. What I'll be speaking about today is, in essence, the trajectory of much of what you've been hearing this morning, which is the valuation of laboratory, and I will get right to it. Disclosures, very specific to this presentation, Project Santa Fe Foundation, which you'll hear specifically about. I'm chair of the board of directors, one of the charter members, and I have two other board activities that are completely unrelated to this talk. Three objectives. The first, and I feel very strongly about this, is laboratory leadership. All of us have a job to do. Our entire workforce is putting out an incredibly valuable source of information for patient care. But what's the leadership we need to be providing collectively to truly change the human condition? I'll speak to the strategic objectives to attempt to do that. Not efficiency in the laboratory, more efficient healthcare delivery. And as time allows, I'll give you two case studies. Again, I'll keep my eye on the clock. This is a new slide because I thought, particularly here at Executive War College, it would be worth just reflecting for a couple of slides on what the roots of all of this Lab 2.0 stuff is. And I view Lab 2.0 as shorthand for driving the value of lab in this next era of American healthcare. It really, to me, goes back to the dawn of the patient-centered medical home in 1967 when the American Academy of Pediatrics was able to demonstrate that children who had a primary care pediatrician did better when they had asthma. Asthmatic children did better when they had a medical home. And it took 40 years for that concept to ultimately be affirmed by the American Academy of Physicians, American Association of Family Physicians, and the American Osteopathic Association as the patient-centered medical home. And I actually was on the board of what still is the Primary Care Collaborative. I was the only pathologist in the country who saw the patient-centered medical home and thought, there's something to this. We're falling short as a specialty in laboratory medicine. One of the well-kept secrets is I'm an anatomic pathologist only, and yet I'm spending the second half of my career talking laboratory medicine. So I found the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative. I was on the board, actually contributed a few words to the Affordable Care Act, which memorialized in 2010 the concept of a health home, and as you all know, launched the accountable care organization model. And now it is etched in stone that the CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, wants to focus on person-centered care. And if you go on their webpage, longitudinal accountability for that care. Simultaneous, 2006, the incredibly influential publication by Michael Porter and Elizabeth Olmsted Teesburg, coining the term value-based care. This was even more memorialized in the 2015 Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act, and I'm sure you've seen the charts of all the gobbledygook of the metrics and quality ratings and all that sort of stuff, but in essence, at this point in time, CMS has declared that by 2030, all Medicare beneficiaries and the vast majority of Medicaid beneficiaries will be in a care relationship with accountability for quality and total cost of care. That is the root of the clinical lab movement. Because where are we as laboratorians in that? And I call it the deep roots of Project Santa Fe Foundation. Start with CLIA, 1988. I am a member of CLIAC now, interestingly enough. But if you actually go back to the Federal Register, the enabling legislation was 1988. It was 1992 before the Federal Register pushed out the first performance requirements, and then just a couple of months later, the CMS final rule implemented the accrediting provisions of CLIA. including granting deeming authority to qualified accreditation organizations, which I've listed at the bottom, and you're all familiar with them. And to me, one of the major issues of archives, pathology, laboratory medicine, and in my career was a collection of articles in 2014, I won't say declaring victory, but basically saying, look at what we've accomplished, which is Six Sigma accuracy in the delivery of laboratory testing. But for me, and I already was engaged with the patient-centered medical home, under the value-based payment system, the clinical laboratory, and this includes AP, is a commodity. Welcome to 2010, to the current time. And so, and I give thanks to Koshro, who responded to a challenge I gave him in 2015, which is let's do something about it. And Koshro organized, Koshro Shatterbani, sitting in the front row, organized a retreat in Santa Fe, New Mexico, hence the name Project Santa Fe, to ask the question, are clinical laboratory services strictly a commodity, or do laboratory services have a higher valuation that can drive better outcomes for patients, providers, and financial stakeholders? And it took another year to get this out into academic pathology. By the way, there's method to my madness. I'm editor-in-chief of academic pathology. So if any of you have any scholarly work on the business of healthcare and how to do stuff, talk to me. Our acceptance rate is 70%. And so the mission of Project Santa Fe, and I will read this, to create a disruptive value paradigm and explore alternative business models that expand the role of diagnostic services in the future healthcare system. This is what I'm dedicating the second half of my career to. It really started with working with Koshro and the other members of Project Santa Fe in 2016. And I won't read the whole second box, but the basic idea is to leverage what we are already doing and our expertise. We know stuff. We understand patients. And to work with partners. You don't do this alone. Medicine is a team sport. And yes, call it a movement. I'm from the Arlo Guthrie generation. My draft number was 103. The draft went up to 90 in my year. It was cutting a little close. And if you remember Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant, if two people walk into a restaurant and sing the Alice's Restaurant Massacre, they think they're both nuts. But if three people walk in, can you imagine three? It's a movement. Well, this is a movement. Thank you for attending. Okay. We all must do Lab 1.0. Northwell Health has over 2,200 laboratory professionals. We must turn out a good product, which is high precision, accurate, reliable, timely. Interesting point came up to me along this journey, which is safety. Patients are concerned about safety. Is my specimen going to get lost? Is it going to get mislabeled? Is someone going to diagnose cancer in the wrong breast? Expertise, and the word we use at Northwell is presence. We can be expert all we want, but if we're up to our eyeballs in the daily grind, you know, needs of running the laboratory and we don't ever get to talk with our medical colleagues, we're not present. We have to help them practice medicine. Innovation. You heard lots about innovation in this morning's session. And never forget that financials are what the world goes around. I'm looking at a particular member of the audience who's speaking tomorrow. We have to be mindful of what we do economically as a commodity, but even more importantly, our financial impact on the entire delivery of healthcare and hopefully on our regional system. And it's in the 2017 paper. Again, Lab 2.0 is shorthand for the concepts that we provide value. And to quote, oh, thank you, whatever, to quote our own director of risk management at Northwell, an integrated delivery network cannot function without having laboratory as an essential component. And so we need to strive to be that essential component and not a commodity, quite honestly, which can be outsourced with the stroke of a pen. I don't think we've crossed this frontier yet, although it's much more available to us, consumers. Do they understand the importance of laboratory? If you talk to any patient with diabetes or chronic kidney disease, they know lab. They live their lives by the lab value. Same for a survivor of cancer. We need to be a partner in their journey. we need to be a partner for providers. I found that by going out on sales calls, a doctor could care less about what's in my CV. The only thing that matters is, am I and is our lab going to help that doctor take care of her or his patients? Health system, that's where the rubber hits the road. Does your corporation value as a laboratory? And that's financial as well as quality performance. And yes, nowadays health system executives are held accountable for the patient experience, for sure, and patient outcomes. And I also feel labs should be enhancing the brand value. You know, I drive from Long Island under the Queens Midtown Tunnel, and there's a billboard right there. I want Northwell Health to have the brand identity that is built in part on laboratory. And payers, that's also undiscovered country. Can we work directly with payers in their product design and help their members do better? So Lab 2.0 is a unifying concept where a lab develops the evidence base for valuation of laboratory and pathology services, gets credit for that evidence base, where we optimize diagnostic as well as therapeutic care, and transitions in care coordination are a place where there are many gaps. We lead wellness care and screening and monitoring, and I have personal experience in, you know, parking lots and tents and that sort of stuff. Laboratory can lead this stuff and step forward, but it must be translated into quantifiable measures. They have to be measurable. They can't be imputed. They have to be realized. Population outcomes and economic outcomes. And what I say to my colleagues, especially my academic colleagues who are supposed to be doing research and that sort of stuff, pay attention to what your health system's doing. Your health system is giving you the keys to the kingdom by consolidating and becoming regional powerhouses. Be the integrative laboratory. Don't forfeit the field. And payers are interested. And something I found is that the smaller payers are interested in innovative programming to get at the market of the bigger payers. So you can there's more traction, at least in my experience, with some of the smaller payers. And so two summary slides of Lab 2.0. Lab is a first responder. I was at the Clinical Lab Management Association conference in April of 2018 and heard Christopher Barney, who was a kidney transplant recipient, and describing his own journey into kidney failure. And he gave me permission to quote him as pointing at our laboratory audience and saying, "You are first responders. You are the ones who see my data first. You have a moral responsibility to ensure that it's acted upon." And he gave me permission to quote him. Because we are embedded in the workflow, we see the data first, and we are the ones who are in the system, whether we are a reference lab or an integrated lab within a health system, to make sure that that data is actionable. And moreover, if that data isn't there, it means there's a gap in care. Patients not getting their annual screens and that sort of stuff. And so we can rule in or rule out. We can certainly identify effective therapies. And again, we have a moral responsibility for doing so. And the reason we're population health is that we have the longitudinal data. If you look at the churn in the marketplace for insurance products, until you get to Medicare Advantage, particularly amongst the employer market, employers are changing their, you know, carriers and so on and so forth. Patients are bouncing around between products, but they're probably in your lab data. And for those of you who attended Rick Vanessa's session this morning, get the attributed patient list at the start of the year. Get a monthly feed. Identify the patients that are there. We have intelligence. We have longitudinal intelligence, and we can sort of cut through all of that churn. With Medicare, the population is more sticky, which means we have more opportunity to work with payers on benefits planning for chronic disease management. But we can identify care gaps. We can identify high-risk patients. And always a team sport, we can provide leadership in facilitating intervention. And something my own colleague, Dwayne Brining, says at Northwell Health, we're the best deal the health system's ever going to get. We're 3 cents on the dollar. If there's an improvement, we can propagate it through the health system immediately. And we've got phlebotomists with sharp needles who have more touches with patients than any other single healthcare provider in the entire health system. Make sure they're professional and make sure they get credit for the job they do in the patient experience. So this is a very wordy slide. The fundamental premise is that Lab 1.0 is transactional. It's reactive. By the way, these slides, the PDF should be available to all of you. And if, quite honestly, if any of you want them, I can PDF them to you by email. Yes, we do disease screening. Yes, we're part of wellness programming, but it's always reactive. And Lab 2.0 is integrative. It's diagnostic intelligence for all the things I've been talking about. So back to a bit of the reflection, you know, what's the history that we've traveled? The initial retreat, April of 2016, 2017, Project Santa Fe Foundation LLC was created as a nonprofit educational foundation. And since April of 2017, we've been holding annual open conferences. My next slide is hold the date for next year. By invitation, we have retreats in the fall of the year. And it's interesting to see that Robert Michel has thought well enough of Lab 2.0 to invite presentations here, a bit of a hiatus during the COVID years. And the being an educational foundation also enables us to provide unrestricted grants to demonstration projects, which have included acute kidney injury, chronic kidney disease, which I'll discuss, anemia, critical values, sepsis, opioids, and I'm principal for a steatotic liver disease demonstration project that's just getting underway. I'll discuss two demonstrations. Well, chronic kidney disease is a demonstration project. Save the date. March 3rd to 5th, 3rd to 4th, fly in on the 2nd and get a reception at the Pendry Hotel in Chicago. It's a magnificent nouveau architecture hotel on Michigan Avenue, just up the street from the Art Institute. That's the conference room. You get comfortable chairs. We limit attendance to about 120, 110 to 130. So it is a good ticket. And It's a wonderful opportunity to spend a day and three quarters immersed in, with like-minded people and how we are moving healthcare forward. So is this movement making any difference? Well, the 2017 Academic Pathology publication has 47 citations now. You know, not a lot. It's about 6 to 8 per year. I'm not versed in altmetric scores, but it's a sort of a social traffic. I'm told 20 is good, but what I like is over 11,000 downloads, and they're not all me, is that there is traffic for this concept, and actually doing sort of a sounding board of some of our clinical laboratory people, one quote is worth bringing forward, which was an individual reflecting back to me. If your goal was to get the conversation started in the laboratory industry, you have succeeded, even if your demonstration projects have taken forever to get done. But the problem is we're in our own echo chamber. This is Executive War College. This is not Becker. And is anyone else listening? Health system leadership, payers, population health leadership. Kashro and I are making the rounds with Health Management Academy. And basic idea is, gee whiz, we never thought that lab might be helpful to us in pop health. The only pop health officer who said, yeah, I know about you guys, was at Intermountain, because Intermountain was one of the founding members of Project Santa Fe. So we haven't broken through the glass ceiling. I'm going back to my roots and very appreciative of the connections that COLA is now providing back for Clinical Lab 2.0 to the Primary Care Collaborative and the board of COLA, which is very primary care oriented, and consumers. Our relationship in the end is with patients. So my personal conclusion, at least right now, is that Clinical Lab 2.0 is a battle won in detail, and the strategic and tactical objectives have to be explicit and realized value to specific stakeholders. You can't just make global statements. You have to do stuff that's specific. And it's the cumulative and unending, what have you done for me lately, quantitative evidence of sustained value that, in my opinion, raises the clinical laboratory from commodity to asset status, and you have to earn that every day. And you cannot take it for granted, because quite honestly, a stroke of the pen and the commodity is gone, or at least partially disassembled. So we actually have five very nicely published case studies of Clinical Lab 2.0, and they're spread out through the years. For those of you who do get a hold of the slide deck, you can see they span from 2018 to just a couple of weeks ago. The chronic kidney disease is an observational study, which I will present to you, which was just published this month, so you can pull it down off the web. And I do have time to present two of them. For those of you who attended Rick Panessa's session this morning, I'm going to do in two slides what he did in a few more, which is basically TriCor and the Rhodes Group, Rhodes being the informatics arm of TriCor, worked with the state Medicaid program. They call it Centennial Care. This is Medicaid. My recollection, Rick, is 90% of all infants born in New Mexico are on Medicaid? 70%? And they're rural. They're not just along the strip of interstate that cuts through New Mexico. Identify the Medicaid members who have a history of testing with TriCor, identify ones who have a positive pregnancy test, and if they don't have an HbA1c, they should, and if they do have an HbA1c, they definitely, I mean, they're going to need prenatal care anyway. And also hepatitis C screening. Because the goal with hepatitis C in terms of cost avoidance for the state is sustained viral response. And the 2021 results are published. This slide that Rick provided to me also includes 2022. What did the state save in having timely and effective prenatal care and management of diabetes so that a 4,000-gram child, newborn, does not land in the NICU? And what is the state saving for having sustained viral response for hepatitis C? And over 2 years, that's $15 million. To me, the real message is, what's the improvement in the human condition? Your child, newborn child, is not in the NICU. You get to go home with your kid. You don't have hepatitis C in your liver. So to me, it is one of the most stunning examples of working with the state of New Mexico, in this case, to change the trajectory of the human condition as a laboratory. This next I'll spend a few more slides on, which was a study. It's an observational, retrospective, non-interventional study of chronic kidney disease with Geisinger, University of Vermont, and Northwell Health in collaboration with the National Kidney Foundation and, yes, Project Santa Fe. How are we doing with chronic kidney disease? And you can pull this off any website, in this case the CDC. About 37 million U.S. adults with chronic kidney disease, most are undiagnosed. That's 15% of all adults in the United States. And one out of three adults with diabetes have chronic kidney disease. One out of five adults with hypertension have chronic kidney disease. I was very glad I've got hypertension. It's controlled, but I was very glad when my creatinine came back normal last week in an annual physical exam. And one out of two patients are expected to develop CKD in their lifetime. This is a major disease. But 40% of those with reduced kidney function, and that's defined by EGFR, are not aware of having CKD. I mean, come on. The cost is substantial, $87 billion total for treating Medicare beneficiaries. And when you get to end-stage renal disease, you tack on an additional $37 billion. These numbers are the same as they were 15 years ago. They have not changed in 15 years. Affordable Care Act, MACRA, all that stuff. And so if you tell the story, and this isn't Christopher Barney, but it could just as well be him, years in primary care in which lab tests are done. And as I listen to Christopher Barney, I haven't heard this particular advocate, I heard Christopher Barney tell essentially the same diagnosis, productive life, diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, okay, got that, diagnosis of hypertension. And despite the fact that lab tests were being performed, it wasn't until the story I was hearing, edema up to his armpits, that a diagnosis of chronic kidney disease was made, and the vast majority of patients with chronic kidney disease are diagnosed within about 6 months of when they need to go on renal replacement therapy. To me, that's a staggering failure of American healthcare. And it's interesting because the recent congressional legislation for accountability for renal disease is for end-stage renal disease. Northwell just got a contract with a major provider of dialysis. Great, we're going to do accountable care for patients who are stage 5 CKD. What about stage 3, 4? Because the creatinines were going up through years and were never identified as being decline in kidney function. And Lab 2.0 is to get upstream, is to be proactive, to own our own data and work within the system. Kashro had challenged me as a physician, make this meaningful. These are not just lab data. So I went back to the literature. This is the paper on the left, 2012, from the Scandinavian Journal of Urology. It is the publication that provided the data to split CKD3 into 3A and 3B. And this is their statistics of dialysis-free survival on the left, where for stage 3A, over 10 to 12 years, there's a certain decline of kidney function into renal replacement therapy, dialysis, and for stage 3B, it's greater. But it's really interesting if you look at a more recent publication from 2020. Once a patient goes on dialysis, if you look on the right, their survival is 50% at 5 years. You do better with cancer than you do with end-stage renal disease. And so the study of Geisinger, University of Vermont, and Northwell, and the order is different here. I intentionally mixed up the order, but these are, I hope, self-respecting institutions, was to look at our own lab data and identify patients on the basis of HbA1c for diabetes, EGFR for chronic kidney disease, and BNP for heart failure, and identify in the year that it was 2021 all of our patients who met laboratory criteria for these three diseases and the overlap, and then to see how well we were doing in documenting in the electronic health record by ICD-10 codes the presence of chronic kidney disease. The first thing is a patient with diabetes, in this case defined as an HbA1c is 6.5% or greater, not screened for CKD, which is a serum creatinine and a urine microalbumin. 59% of institution A, that's Northwell, by the way, 82% of institution B, 77% of diabetes were not being screened in the year 2021 for CKD. And then if you say, okay, how is the CKD identified? Lab results only without an ICD-10, that's 78% of Northwell patients with laboratory evidence of CKD had laboratory only and no ICD-10 in the year that was 2021. Institution B, UVM, smaller institution, 32%. Institution C, 66%. This is not good. You know, I'd like to think Northwell is a good institution. But we're not, you know, and this lab, I've been talking about Lab 2.0 for 10 years now, and we're not getting the job done. The interesting thing is, and I give credit to Rick and Kathy Swanson for working through these numbers, publicly available information by state for the three institutions allows us to impute the number of our own patients who were on Medicare Advantage, which is an accountable form of care. And you can see for stage 3 and stage 4, all three institutions together, both in the Medicare Advantage program as well as the Affordable Care Act CKD stage 4. The number given, 3531, is out of 36,000 total patients between the three institutions who had laboratory evidence of CKD. And the interesting thing is by not coding those patients, we lost 2 million plus 0.6 million plus 0.6 million of risk adjustment. To me, that's not absence of money to care for these patients. It's absence of care, because there is published literature that if you don't code in the medical record, chances are you didn't provide that care. And if you scale this up to the national numbers, that translates current numbers, 2021, publicly available, and again, this is imputed, which is why it's not on the paper, 3.3 million Medicare Advantage patients in the U.S. and $2.1 billion of the U.S. healthcare dollar are not being leveraged to care for these patients because we don't even identify them. And if we go back to our actuarial curves here, what that means is that for our three institutions in this observational study, 60% of our 3A patients are not being diagnosed, and 30% of our stage 3B are not being diagnosed. The interesting thing is that the all-cause mortality for stage 3 CKD at 10 years is 50% because you die of coronary artery disease. There are multiplying factors here. We're not just taking care of the kidneys. And this is where I brought it home for Kashra, which is, so let's look at breast cancer. On the left is the survival of patients with metastatic breast cancer. And I've put in the little red circle the dialysis-free survival of a patient with CKD stage 3. So the CKD is you need to go on dialysis, the breast is you die. But still, that's a survival curve which is comparable. But once you have metastatic, on the left it's early breast cancer, non-metastatic. On the right is metastatic breast cancer. And yes, if you have metastatic breast cancer to the brain, your survival is worse than a CKD patient. But I think it is very interesting that a CKD patient on dialysis is in the same time frame as a patient with breast cancer metastatic to the brain. And yet, we're kind of not paying attention. And in terms of magnitude, this is a Lancet publication. Worldwide, life years lost and deaths, CKD is more than breast cancer. So I've made a comparison in saying we have work to do. What are we doing at Northwell? This is a relationship with primary care, nephrology, and endocrinology to work together to identify these patients. We're focusing on our risk products because that's where the risk adjustment is. Don't boil the ocean, just boil the Mediterranean, which is a sea, by the way, not an ocean. But get to work on it. And the goals of this tripartite partnership are to empower primary care with the reports and tools so that they can identify these patients and refer them appropriately. And for lab in the bottom to be a facilitator of faster and more standardized effective care. So to bring this home, what have we learned from demonstration projects? Number one, they're not easy. Number two, they're institution-specific. One institution's lab 2.0 may not be another's. We found that with acute kidney injury. Building real-world evidence base for our value was hard. And the other thing is the clinical lab fee schedule doesn't fund this stuff. We're doing this, quite honestly, on the side. The economic outcomes must be realized. They cannot be imputed. I was told early on in my time at Northwell, Jim, you can't take credit for that reduction in length of stay. Someone else has already claimed credit for it. You got to figure out beforehand how you're going to get credit. But at the same time, whatever you're doing, it needs to matter to your C-suite, starting with your CEO. Whatever you're doing, the CEO and the COO and the CMO, et cetera, and the CFO, I could go on, CQO. CNO, need chief patient experience. They need to care about it. They need to care about what you're doing. And if they don't, you're not thinking big enough. So going back to our mission, Project Santa Fe does have a structure to it. We are trying to provide thought leadership. We are certainly trying to push the business model. And as described, we're trying to build the evidence. If you have any interest in being part of this movement, Kashra and I are down front. We'd love to talk with you. And so to use a slide that Kashra has used at the beginning of his talk, I'm using at the end of my talk. Have we reached an inflection point? And that's Andrew Grove with the Intel near-death experience is when you reach a near-death inflection point, it's a beginning just as it might be an end. And in essence, we are moving from volume-based care to value-based care. It's kind of dangerous in the middle because you still have to make your living on the volume-based care. But we still have some lead time. Why does Project Santa Fe feel bullish? because lab becomes the highest yield asset that a health system can drive, both for risk adjustment quality ratings, for risk management, which gives you realized revenue and cost avoidance. Yes, you have to play the economic game, but we have the opportunity in doing that to achieve better population outcomes, reduce total cost of care, avoidance of cost, and yes, decreased economic burden to the patient. So I, in the interest of time, am going to shift to the end, which is to do this, you need to form your institutional and regional teams to implement programs. You need to identify at-risk individuals and define the service model for delivering best practice care, and you need to deploy, and then you need to measure those outcomes, operate within the existing and future value-based paradigm. Medicare has laid out all the jelly beans for us, CMS. They're there. Same token, on a daily basis, constantly strive to identify new opportunities. Once you've achieved something of benefit, it's baked into the next year's budget. You have to continue to achieve. And yes, go vertical in your learning. You need to know about healthcare policy, payments, market trends. That's why you come to Executive War College, by the way. Disruptors in the marketplace, consumerism, but the opportunities abound. They really are everywhere. Biggest barrier, business model of U.S. healthcare is based on us as a commodity. At the current time, there is no business model for Lab 2.0. I am a huge fan of Tricor, which is work. Sorry for all the call-outs, Rick, but I think you deserve it. Direct working relationships with payers, because this is a separate product in the end. For Northwell Health, and you heard me say this at Rick's session in the morning, Northwell Health, we are part of the integrated budget. So our success as an in-system integrated laboratory is to have Northwell Health achieve financial health. So we don't need a separate payment line for our data science group. If you're a reference lab, it actually is a different product, and you need a separate payment line. But again, win the battle in detail, meaning have quantifiable, realized value. The return on the investment must be in clear view. 2-to-1 is okay, by the way, because even 2-to-1 means you're improving the human condition. And yes, advocacy and policy change, I think, will help. But something I've been saying is, do your health systems or your payers or however you define your client base, do their patients do better for you being their laboratory? You have to prove it. You can't take it for granted. Going back to Christopher Barney's statement, the lab's impact doesn't end when we release a result. That's where it begins. And I thank you all, and I've left time for questions. We've got about 13 minutes. Kasha.
Softball, okay. You as an officer and a physician highlighted the value of the longitudinal view quite well and quite carefully. What are your thoughts in consolidation days when C-level have no idea of the intelligence they're already sitting on, either selling a portion of their lab or then outsourcing the entire lab and its effect on longitudinal view? It's essential in early detection.
So the question is, if the lab is partially or in full divested by a corporate leadership, what, quite honestly, is lost as regards to the longitudinal data? And our Northwell Lab 2.0 journey started before Project Santa Fe. I mean, really, it started when I had the privilege of joining Northwell in 2009, because the third day I was there, we were meeting with a board of trustees subcommittee that was examining whether to accept the offer from a commercial lab to sell the lab. And we actually published that, 2019 Archives Lab Medicine. If you want to read about that particular meeting and the 10-year outcome, that's why we wrote up the paper. Joe was smiling. Talk about near-death experiences. What you lose cannot be given back by the payers. The statement that was made at the time was, no, but your lab data goes to the payers. Your lab data, you know, we get the commercial lab data, goes to the payers, we've got our nurse coordinators at the payer level, and we'll be fine. The evidence does not support that premise. If you look at CKD, being an in-system lab doesn't really support the premise either. We certainly have work to do. But going back to my statement about presence, with us, ENCE, not ENTS, is the fact that the in-system laboratory, or again, a reference laboratory with the longitudinal data, whatever the aggregator is, has two assets. The first is we see the data in real time at the time of delivery. There is no lag time. When that result comes off the machine, or quite honestly, when I as an anatomic pathologist push the button diagnosing cancer, that second we know that we can start care coordination. And the other thing is we're the in-system experts. We have the working relationships with our medical colleagues, with hospital leadership, with nursing, with quality, with our phlebotomists. We have the entire integrated network. And if you dissemble that, quite honestly, there's no one home at the lab when you call if the lab is outsourced. The labs are designed to run as lean as possible. There's no one to pick up the phone, with some notable exceptions. There are reference labs that absolutely are stunning in picking up the phone, but it's not the general thing. And I think part of that is that the presence of a reference lab, I'd say it goes up with the acuity of the test. You don't get presence with a creatinine, but you clearly need that presence if you're going to take care of a population where, you know, 30% of your population has a chronic disease. So it's a shall we say, I'm enthusiastic about answering this question. The Lab 2.0 movement is very definitely includes as its mission valuing the in-system lab. However that is defined, it includes reference laboratories that are regional. And we have some wonderful examples here at Executive War College. And I'm a big admirer of the regional reference laboratories as well as the in-system labs. Other questions? Yes, Rick.
Dr. Crawford, you mentioned you're approaching nephrology and endocrinology with that study that you did. How are they, are they receptive?
The interesting thing is the question is, so we are approaching nephrology and endocrinology, and yes, primary care. Our chair of family practice at Northwell Health is the current chairperson of the board of the American Academy of Family Physicians. We got influence through that. They are raring to go. And the irony is that when the chief of nephrology arrived at Northwell about 10 years ago, he just arrived, and he approached me and said, Jim, I'm about to meet with a donor to set up a chronic kidney disease program. Can you give me any data on chronic kidney disease? And within an hour, I gave him 2.5 million creatinine results, anonymized. And I removed the inpatient, which would be the acute kidney injury. And he walked into the room with 1 million unique patients with chronic kidney disease and a donor. And that was a successful encounter. The chronic kidney disease program at Northwell was founded out of that meeting. I actually wanted to make sure when we submitted this paper to BMC Nephrology that, Steve was aware I was sending it in because, we're kind of institution A. And own it. If we're not providing the care we need to provide, get upstream and provide it. So in the case of Northwell, we've got our managed care accountable contracts for end-stage renal disease. We're off to the races. Done. Now we do the CKD 3 and 4. And this data is empowering, and I can assure you it's motivating. That's not what we want on the billboard going into the Queens Midtown Tunnel. Own your data, good, bad, and ugly. Other questions? Okay. Oh, yes.
Dr. Crawford, can you attribute any of the cost of handling CKD cost reduction to moving your care from bedside to curbside?
So the question is, can we attribute total cost of delivering care from bedside to curbside with what we're doing? That is a fundamental question. And I deleted from the slide deck the publicly available information on how much it costs to take care of patients with CKD3, let alone 4 and 5, throw in diabetes, throw in cardiovascular disease. The costs just go up astronomically. And there are effective therapies for CKD3. You don't have to go into end-stage renal disease if you're CKD3. So before we even get to quality of life, you can save money by keeping a patient out of CKD3. You can lower the multiplying effect of cardiovascular disease. You can hopefully help them manage their diabetes. You're giving them years of life at lower cost.
Indian Health Services.
And yes, thank you. Indian Health Services, this is Elizabeth Montgomery of the National Kidney Foundation speaking, has, if you think on about a thin dime program, it's Indian Health Services. They have cut in half over the last 20 years the incidence of CKD in their beneficiary population on a dime that's thinner than any of us have in our health system. You know, the rest of the United States is going up. Indian Health Services beneficiaries have gone down 50% in their incidence of CKD. And if you, we actually at the Chicago workshop in end of February 2024, we had Indian Health Services and National Kidney Foundation on the podium. How do you do that? You work with the community. First and foremost, you work with the community. You earn their trust. Then you start providing care, which is why I'm published in saying all healthcare is local. You could say regional, but you work within your community. And we learned that, and we demonstrated that during COVID. Well, let's roll up our sleeves and do it for chronic disease. Question.
Dr. Crawford, this may be a very naive comment question, but when you said, you know, Lab 2.0 really doesn't have a funding source, there's not a reimbursement for it, is it, you should be able to claim the cost savings.
Okay, so the question is, can if you do Lab 2.0, welcome to Northwell Health budget season, can laboratory claim the cost saving?
I mean, you have to be able to prove it.
You have to be able to prove that cost saving was realized, which is lower incidence of, you know, CKD 4 and 5, lower hospital. Actually, my... I'm a liver pathologist. What am I doing this? When I was at the University of Florida, I was approached by the Florida Healthcare Coalition. They just wanted me to find them an epidemiologist. What wound up happening was that my laboratory administrative director, Cynthia Beavis, ran the program for Walt Disney World to provide wellness care. Lab was running wellness care for Walt Disney World pre-diabetic and diabetic patients. We kept patients out of hospital. And as soon as the program ended, the patients started going back to hospital. And that's published, 2014. And so, yes, you can get at hospitalizations and renal replacement therapy and other very high-cost events. But what the Disney Project, and by the way, Walt Disney World didn't want to be named. It's just an employer in Florida. If you search Disney, you won't find the paper. It's a stochastic event. One hospitalization will pay for the entire program. The difference between 4 hospitalizations and 11 hospitalizations is a major program. So it's a the costs of the bomb going off are stochastic, and that's what you're trying to avoid. But never forget, there's a human life here, and potentially family and survivors, and that's very motivating. Okay. Oh, one more question.
Yeah. So, last question. So, the data's there, right? And
data's disease, there.
But disease is going undiagnosed, right?
So and the examples given, yes.
Right. So that is nobody currently looking at that data? Is the
at 12 minutes in E&M, it's a problem.
Perfect. So then, where does the clinical decision support fit into this?
Yeah. So the question is, if the data is already there, why is no one looking at it? Where does clinical decision support fit in? And Valerie White mentioned that this morning. Keep in mind the perspective of the overworked primary care provider who gets home at the end of the day and then spends the next 3 hours sending emails out to patients and making phone calls, my own primary care provider included. It's a tough go. And so, yes, you can build the primary care medical home, patient-centered medical home, around that provider. But that's still not data. And so both the infrastructure and the ability to deploy a system that acts on this data has many arms to it. The first is just prioritizing the patient registry. Who's not gotten their creatinine and microalbumin this year? Who's not gotten the foot exam, for that matter? You know, to at least get the HCCs taken care of. But more importantly, make sure you get in your priority patients. And that is a data feed process, but it's not the primary care physician who has to ream through that. The health systems are doing this. Their population health, their risk management are building these systems. But it's still two hands clapping in the dark. And talking with the population health people at Health Management Academy, they're just as frustrated as we are. It's not yet working. These systems are not yet working. I think the sharpest end of the spear is risk adjustment, because the healthcare, you know, payers and health system together feel the pain of those dollars.
I feel compelled to share it. Tariq and I have actually spoken. Why is it that e-commerce and banking can detect a fraud in seconds, yet we can detect a condition of clinical? That's nonsense. It's not lack of technology. We don't get paid to connect that. We are not the business.
We don't have the business model to connect these dots.
I don't think it's technology or clinical decision support. We just need to change the business model alternative payment. Otherwise, we're sitting on that thing.
Yeah, so to repeat, yeah, the business model does have to change. Time's up. I'll stay here for any further questions. If you want to be part of the movement, please. Love to have you help move this forward.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.